Reed.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Court, John Reed for the appellees. With me today in the courtroom is the President of ASB, Mr. Robert Bellinger. And at counsel table is Scott Zawanka from our Delaware office, Bruce Barnett from our Boston office, and Bruce Falby, also from our Boston office. And with the permission of the Court, Mr. Falby will be presenting the argument.
Welcome to the Court, everyone.
Good morning.
Mr. Williams.
Your Honors, if I might, I would introduce the folks at our counsel table as well. My colleague Richard Zucchino from the Honigman Miller firm is here with us, as well as my partner Kelly Farnan and our associate Catherine Lester.
Welcome.
May it please the Court, Gregory Williams on behalf of the appellant. Your Honors, with the Court's indulgence, I would like to address the attorney's fee issue first, and that is the opposite order that the issues are presented in the brief. I believe it's appropriate in this circumstance because we believe that the Court's holding with respect to attorney's fees is its most egregious error below of several errors, but the most egregious. It is of disproportionate importance in this case, the award of attorney's fees compared to the amount in controversy. And I also want to make sure that given how quickly arguments go in this Court, I have time to address the fees question fully. Your Honors, the fee question is subject to de novo review. It rests on the interpretation of a provision of a contract. We submit that Section 9.9 of the agreement is unambiguous. It provides that the non-prevailing party shall reimburse the prevailing party for costs and expenses incurred. It is undisputed that ASB was not charged by DLA Piper for its representation in this litigation. At page 33 of the appellee's brief, it says that DLA represented ASB, quote, free of charge. Now, we all know what that means. That means that they weren't charged anything, they didn't pay anything, they didn't incur any fees and expenses. And, Your Honors, I would submit this point really comes down to common sense. It's not a difficult legal argument. It's a clear contract, and common sense tells us that if you're not charged for something, you didn't incur the expenses, and you can't be reimbursed. The contract uses the word reimbursed. We just can't get reimbursed for monies that we didn't spend. So how does the court below justify this fee award? Two points, and I would submit neither of them comes close to justifying the fee award. First, the court says, well, this is not unlike an insurance situation, and if ASB had litigation insurance, I would still be awarding fees under a fee-shifting provision. And, Your Honors, we would submit it's completely unlike an insurance situation. With an insurance situation, the insured pays out of its pocket. It prepays for legal fees and expenses to be covered by insurance.
You mean by premium?
By premiums, yes. Once those premiums are paid and once you have coverage, if you draw down on your policy, there will be higher premiums to pay in the future, as sure as night follows day. In many cases, insureds are billed directly by their lawyers. They pay the lawyers, and then they get reimbursement from their insurance company. In all cases, the insurance company will offset, with respect to the monies it has to pay to its insured, recovery that the insured gets from a third party. The insurance company will also subrogate itself so that it has rights to go against the party against whom the insured has rights.
Mr. Williams, can we backtrack just for a moment?
Yes, sir.
Is it accurate to say that your side's legal argument is that the plain meaning of the word incur in this contract requires the result the opposite of what the court reached, and that the error here was in assigning to that language a meaning that was at odds with the plain meaning?
Absolutely, and not just incur, but also reimburse.
Well, Mr. Williams, let's suppose the scenario was a little different, and DLA Piper said, look, we're going to not send you any bills. We're going to represent you. But if you win, then under the contract, you'd be entitled to your fees, and then we'd get paid if you win, but if you lose, nothing. So there's, how does that relate to incur and reimburse? If that was the arrangement, would there still be no award of fees?
Your Honor, let me say first, there's nothing in the record that that was, in fact, the arrangement.
I understand. It's a complete hypothetical.
Yes, complete hypothetical. I think it'd be closer in the sense that, in effect, they're sort of conditionally incurring the expenses. They know that they are, it would be in that likelihood, I believe they would likely be receiving bills, and they would know that if they prevailed and they availed themselves of fee shifting, they would get the money and they would pay it to DLA Piper. I think it could be a different result, very different from this situation where what happened was, it's in the record, the lower court found ASB threatened DLA with a malpractice claim. And DLA, for its own good and sufficient purposes, I don't fault it at all, I credit it, said, well, you know what, for our business purposes, we will represent you free of charge. You're not going to pay a nickel under any circumstance. That's undisputed. It's a very different situation, Your Honor.
Well, the court did give a reason for not assigning to the term incurred what you argue is the plain meaning. It was a policy reason. What was wrong with that policy reason?
Your Honor, the court said there were two reasons why it was awarding fees. One, the insurance example. Secondly, it said there are two sides to this contract. And it said the non-breaching side must pay the breaching side. And that's where the court is going. And it said, you know, this is the way the contract works. The non-breaching side pays the breaching side. And let me read to you the language of the court's opinion because it's very important. Here, the non-breaching side, I'm reading from page 40, the non-breaching side of the case caption litigated the dispute at a significant cost, albeit a cost that DLA Piper and ASB have allocated between themselves. The contractual fee-shifting provision, this is where he gets to the policy, obligates the breaching side of the caption to bear that cost regardless of the allocation between DLA Piper and ASB. It's a fundamental mistake. He speaks of ASB and DLA Piper as they are on one side of the caption, as they're parties to the litigation. DLA Piper is not a party to this litigation, and the contract, the plain language of the contract, speaks with respect to parties. The breaching party and the non-breaching party, and the court below conflates counsel and its client. You can't do that. DLA was not a party to this litigation, and the court below's ruling is based on an assumption that it was.
Well, the policy, if I understood the court's opinion correctly, is that not to enforce the fee-shifting provision would create the wrong incentives in future cases.
Your Honor,
that is, it would give the wrongdoer a windfall that's undeserved.
And Your Honor, I dispute certainly the concept that there was a windfall here. My clients paid $1.8 million out of their own pocket. Yes, if it had been a different situation and my clients had lost, and ASB had in fact incurred the fees, would we have to pay them? We would. But the fact that we are a beneficiary of the arrangement on the other side between client and counsel doesn't mean that it's a windfall. We paid $1.8 million. The real windfall will be, if this decision stands, to DLA Piper, because one of the world's largest law firms will be receiving a lot of money, over $3 million for the costs of litigating a mistake, the effect of a mistake that they made. That should be contrary to public policy.
Well, this is the reality that either way this case gets decided, that is, this issue gets decided, there's a windfall. It's just a question of which side it falls on.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's true, and I'll explain why. If I were to prevail on the fee issue on appeal, my clients pay their own legal expenses. ASB pays nothing. And DLA Piper has absolved itself, assuming it wins on the merits, has absolved itself of the effect of a malpractice claim. And so there is really, in my mind, no windfall to anyone. There is a real windfall if DLA Piper, having said, we'll do it for free, and the record is clear. They don't deny they made a mistake, a very important mistake. Had they not made the mistake, none of us would be here. Well,
it's basically but for the fortuity of the arrangement that took place between DLA Piper and the client that your side, your client, is not required to pay that which it would otherwise be contractually required to pay. So there is, in that sense, a windfall.
In that sense, although, again, I don't believe there's a windfall, and the reason you say, but for the fortuity, well, if DLA Piper had not made what the court found below was a mistake, we wouldn't be here, and my client wouldn't have to have incurred $1.8 million in litigation expenses either. So I don't believe
well,
this is
a fortuity
like
because DLA Piper could have said, no, we're not going to defend for nothing. We're not going to defend at all. We think you should get other counsel. And it would be a different case.
It would be a different case. And in fact, Your Honor, the real world is, if we want to get very real, the real world is if ASB had to pay money to litigate this, we also may not be here. Because we know that when you tell folks, I'll represent you free of charge, it's not going to cost you a penny, people like litigation a lot more. Oh. And so this case may well have been resolved long before us getting here today.
Did your client ever take the position that DLA Piper did not make a mistake?
Your Honor, we believed, yes, we believed we had a contract that we were entitled to enforce. So,
and your position was that this contract accurately reflected the original intention of the parties?
Yes.
So DLA Piper did not make a mistake?
Well, they were found to have made a mistake, and that's the record that we deal with on appeal.
Mr. Williams, when there are contractual provisions that purport to address the issue of attorney's fees, is there room for the court to interject public policy or equitable bases for fee shifting?
Your Honor, the law of the state of Delaware could not be more clear. I think this is one of the tenets of our law that we would all agree with, that the court enforces an unambiguous contract. And interjecting the personal preferences of the court with respect to parties, whether it liked a party, it didn't like a party, opens us up to the possibility of what one could think is really, in fact, a punitive award of attorney's fees. And I'm not necessarily saying that, but it certainly has that effect in this case. But when the contract is clear and unambiguous, it must be interpreted in accordance with its terms and not how the judges might think the world should be ordered, with all due respect to all the members of the judiciary.
And there's no other argument for an award other than the contractual provision, is that correct?
That is the argument that the court relied upon. That's what we're here for today, yes, Your Honor.
As I understand it, the Vice Chancellor did not interject any inherent equitable authority in crafting a different scheme for fee shifting than that contained in the contract.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is that an issue that he should have addressed? Was it put to him?
Your Honor, our opponents argue that under statutory authority, courts can always award fees when they make the requisite findings, but that was not a decision that the lower court made. He relied on contract interpretation, and it really clearly is a misinterpretation of this contract.
But just to be clear, there yes. was any other basis for an award argued other than the contractual provision?
I believe the statutory provision was argued by my friends below. It was not ruled upon by the lower court.
If we agree with you on the contractual argument, should there be a remand to address the other issue if it's unaddressed?
Your Honor, I think your Honor certainly have the ability to do that, but I think there's no need to do that on this record. The lower court was very careful, and it's not a criticism, but very careful to make findings that it thought might facilitate review on appeal in this case. And it didn't reach any statutory grounds, and I don't think there's a need to. Let me say this with respect to the fee-shifting point. as we, before I move on to other important topics as well. When the lower court engages in these analyses, and my opponents ask the court to look at pro bono cases, cases under federal statutes where indigents are represented pro bono publico, when the lower court talks about the attorneys being on the winning side of the case, what we have here, I would submit respectfully, are legal gymnastics designed to get around the words of the statute. And I really come back to, it's not a windfall. DLA has made a business decision. They shouldn't profit from this litigation. And my clients have paid their fees, and there was no basis under the contract for this award. So with
you,
that, I'd like to...
You earlier said under the language of the statute. You mentioned contract.
I'm sorry, under the contract, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to now move to the reformation points, which are very important points of law. Business people have choices. They can either read contracts before they sign them, or they can just sign them without reading them. If they sign them without reading them, they assume very real risks. I'm guessing, Your Honor.
To get to the heart of your argument, in connection and in relation to the standard of review, is your argument that the court adopted the wrong rule of law, or is your argument that the court adopted the right rule but applied it incorrectly to the facts, or is it some combination of both?
I would say it's primarily a legal argument. It's primarily a legal argument that the court adopted the wrong rules of law. I do think as you apply those laws to these facts, he made mistakes as well.
So what is it, what rule did the court apply, and what rule should the court have applied? Where did the court go wrong in terms of the rule of law dealing with when one is entitled to reformation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In several instances it erred. One, the court said it doesn't matter that Mr. Bellinger, the principal who signed these agreements, the only business person they can rely on that side, it doesn't matter whether he read the contract or not. And there are factual findings that lead to the clear conclusion that Mr. Bellinger did not read the contracts. The court said it doesn't matter whether he read the contracts or not. He's still entitled to come into our courts and get equitable relief with respect to a contract. And we submit that is contrary to decades of Delaware law.
All right. Well, just in terms of the doctrine, is that a negligence, an argument that negligence is an affirmative defense, an equitable defense, or is it an argument that one of the critical elements for reformation is missing here?
Your Honor, I believe it's a critical element of reformation in my mind, but I also am not troubled by it being part of a defense, that you read what you are complaining about before you sign it if you're going to come to court and ask the court to relieve you of the burdens of that contract.
Ask you another hypothetical before you get to that. Let's suppose the parties agree someone will do something for $10,000, and the contract is prepared, and instead of $10,000, it has $100,000. And the person does the job and says, I want $100,000. And in my hypothetical, it's absolutely clear they never read the contract, they just signed it. And in our situation, you know, we have an argument that they didn't read it twice. So let's assume they didn't read it twice. Would the person be entitled to $100,000?
Your Honor, under those facts, and that's going to bring me back to our facts, but under those facts, I think, while that would be a harsh result, I do think that this court could articulate the rule that if you are going to seek reformation, you must have read the contract. And the court said, in its musings on this topic, the Supreme Court, all mistakes involve people who maybe didn't read things carefully enough. I understand that. Many of these contracts are very complicated, and people can read them and try and come to a mistaken understanding. But if you don't even bother to read the document, then I think the court could be comfortable with saying to parties, you have to live with the consequences of your actions.
And we understand that you're making that argument. What I don't understand is how you translate it doctrinally into a rule of law. That is, you've, in answer to my question, you said that the failure to read the contract negatives an element that has to be proved for recovery. Which element?
Your Honor, I believe that this court ought to articulate. It's not been clear with respect to reformation from this court, but it's been articulated by our courts that if you don't read the contract, you can't get reformation. So I believe that's an element.
But why?
I'm also comfortable with it
because, is it because it's not a mistake? Is that the element? I mean, what is it? Which of the elements that make up this cause of action is missing, you know, once you posit that the plaintiff didn't read the contract?
Your Honor, if I could I speak to some of the Delaware court's pronouncements
on this
issue?
If you can answer my question doctrinally, feel free.
Doctrinally, I believe that, as you see in the language of this court and the lower court, it is an element of seeking equitable relief that you've read the contract, because the courts say if you don't read the contract, you can't get the relief. And I also am comfortable with it being part of an affirmative defense. I'm comfortable with it being part of an affirmative defense that when someone comes in and says, please reform my contract.
You may be comfortable, but it matters to us which we're talking about.
Yes.
If it's an affirmative defense, I understand that, and yes, we can deal with that in one way. But if you're negativing part of the cause of action, that may be different.
I believe that in the case law, which I will discuss with you, the courts make clear that it's part of your cause of action. Now, I will also tell you there are places where the courts talk about the elements necessary for reformation, and there's certainly nowhere where the courts say, and you must have read your contract. But let me, if I could, just go to what the courts have said. In the Graham versus State Farm case, Chancery Court, which was affirmed by this court, said, failure to read a contract in the absence of fraud is an unavailing excuse or defense and cannot justify an avoidance, modification, which is reformation, or nullification of the contract or any provision thereof. That was affirmed by this court, and this court said if the Grahams had just read their policy after receiving it, quote, they would have discovered the arbitration clause. Peloton versus New York, your honors are well aware of it. It quoted the U.S. Supreme Court, 100-year-old reasoning. It will not do for a man to enter into a contract and when called upon to respond to its obligations to say he did not read it when he signed it or did not know what it contained.
Well, what if the plaintiff's principal read the contract but simply didn't grasp the significance of what was there?
Your Honor, then to my mind, that may well not rise, depending on the facts of the case. These are all fact intensive. That may well not rise to the type of negligence that would bar reformation.
Okay, so negligence is the key concept here in your
negligence,
argument?
Negligence, and it can also be, this court used the term misconduct.
Okay, if in this case the plaintiff's agent didn't read the contract, that's negligence, correct?
And Your Honor, I submit in these facts, it's worse than negligence. I believe it's gross negligence. Can I explain why? This is not a situation where they relied on the lawyers to draft some lawyer document that the lawyers all had the knowledge of.
Whether it's negligence or gross negligence, the point is you have to read the contract, and if you don't read the contract,
right,
you don't get reformation.
That's exactly right.
But if you do read the contract, and don't do something to change the language to comport with the original, alleged original understanding, then you don't get reformation either because you've waived it. Your right to seek it, right?
No, it would depend on the facts. If the parties made a good faith effort, you can read a contract and misunderstand it and not be negligent, I believe, because some contracts are so hard to understand. But the law is clear in Delaware. You cannot get avoidance of a contract if you didn't read it. Look where the lower court is taking us.
Well, are we talking about reformation or avoidance?
We're talking about reformation, but I want to go to where the lower court is taking us. You cannot get avoidance, that's clear. But you can get reformation in a case of unilateral mistake, even though you didn't read it. So if you have the good fortune, if you don't read your contract and you proceed at your peril, we know that's generally the case under Delaware law, but you have the good fortune to be able to claim there's a unilateral mistake, under the lower court's reasoning, the court will bail you out. And let me just focus for one second. I'm about to eat into all my time. But on the mistake in question here, there has to be a specific, that's the case law's language, specific antecedent agreement that differs from the written one for the court to reform. We all agree with that. My friends agree with that. There was never any discussion, it's undisputed, about where in the waterfall the promotes fall between the parties. There was a discussion of the magnitude of the promotes. That's it. And how many promotes. Where the court found the specific agreement was the court said that the term of art promote has an inherent contemplation based on expert testimony that the promote comes before return of capital. So the alleged unilateral mistake here is based on a term of art which the court, after hearing expert testimony, said this term of art has an inherent contemplation. We cannot be in Delaware, I submit, Your Honors, respectfully, reforming contracts based on a lower court's finding of the inherent contemplation of a supposed term of art. There's too much danger to certain.
So you're arguing to us that the court's finding that there was proof by clear and convincing evidence of an antecedent oral understanding was error?
Your Honor, we did not argue that, and I'll tell you why, if I can answer the question. I see. We didn't argue it because we knew it would fly in the face of lots of factual determinations. And when you read that decision below, you'll see lots of references to demeanor of witnesses, etc.
Well, if you didn't argue it below, why are you arguing it now?
I'm not arguing, Your Honor, that that finding was a mistake. What I'm arguing is if you allow the Delaware courts to reform contracts based on unilateral mistake, look at the mischief we are inviting, because we're inviting reform based on unilateral mistake where the mistaken party didn't read the contract. We're inviting the courts to do things like rewrite a contract based on its finding that a supposed term of art had an implied or an inherent contemplation. We're going to rewrite contracts based on that. And if they had just read the contract, by their own admission, they say, it's undisputed, Mr. Bellinger says in his affidavit, if I'd read the contract, I'd have seen that mistake, and we wouldn't have gone forward. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bruce Felby for the appellee ASB. I want to underscore that the Chancery Court found by clear and convincing evidence all of the elements of the unilateral mistake that this court has set forth repeatedly in the Collins versus Burke case and in the Cerberus case, in which, Chief Justice Steele, you dissented, but you concurred in the statement of the elements. We proved by clear and convincing a prior agreement that ASB was mistaken and that Scion knew of the Scrivener's error in the agreement, knew we were mistaken, and deliberately stayed silent to try to take advantage of it. And they don't appeal any of that. They've waived any argument as to the elements. They raise on appeal the affirmative defense of our negligence, our standard of care. But they don't appeal the finding of knowing silence. In Colvo-Caresses versus Wasserman, which is a seminal Chancery Court case that was relied on both opinions in Cerberus, the court described knowing silence as a species of, quote, inequitable conduct in the nature of fraud. And as this court has held, fraud consists not just of overt statements, but silence in the face of a duty to speak. And the restatement of contracts in sections 161C and 166 confirms that knowing silence of a mistake in the terms of a contract is equivalent to a fraudulent misrepresentation because the party has a duty to speak up and correct the error. So here we
all right, so you're arguing that if the court can take cognizance at all of negligence in the sense of failure to read the contract, it would be only in the context of negligence being an affirmative defense to the reformation claim. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I think they concede that in their briefs. I don't think that's an issue in the case, Your Honor.
All right.
But the posture of this case is that having been found by clear and convincing evidence to have engaged in inequitable conduct in the nature of fraud, Scion says that equity should deny ASB reformation because they say ASB was negligent. So they asked the court to sanction their knowing silence, their inequitable conduct, their fraud, by giving them a multimillion-dollar windfall under agreements that clear and convincing evidence also proves were erroneous. It's an odious position. We ask you to reject it for two reasons. Number one, there's no factual basis for it. Scion claims primarily that Mr. Bellinger, who's here with us today, failed to read the agreements at all. What was his testimony? Referring to the pages of the transcript, at page 41 to 42, he read parts of the agreements, including probably the waterfalls, though he did not recall how much of the documents he read. At page 100, in every case where he signed a document, he reviewed significant parts of the document. If given only a signature page to sign, he had a conversation before signing it with an attorney to make sure that he knew of any changes to the documents since he last signed.
Well, Mr. Felby, the critical portion of the contract is the placement or location of the waterfall, I'm sorry, the return of capital element.
Correct.
It's not clear whether that that particular section was read or whether it wasn't.
Correct.
And what I'm asking that as a sub-question, but the larger question is, what kind of a case do we have here? Is it a case where the contract wasn't read at all, as the other side argues, or is it a case where it was read, but its significance was missed?
We have the first category, where it was read in part, and the ASB missed it. Mr. Bellinger testified at page 42. He typically reads waterfalls, believes he did here, and just missed the mistake. At page 43, he said, once someone points it out, it's obvious it's wrong, like a straightforward typo. He just missed it. And parenthetically, the mistake was a typo. There's a dangling and at the end of what is not the penultimate paragraph, when you put it where it's supposed to be, becomes a penultimate paragraph that shows where it should have gone.
Right, placement or location.
Now, what the court found was that each of the ASB witnesses testified credibly and candidly about their role, his or her role, he said, in contributing to the Scrivener's error. And the only male ASB witness who testified was Mr. Bellinger. So the court specifically credited his testimony. And the court recites at page 14 parts of Mr. Bellinger's testimony, that he read parts of the agreement before approving it, that he did not read the agreement carefully, that he overlooked the placement of the promote ahead of the return of capital, and that once someone points out the mistake, it's wrong. Now, the court repeated on page 29 Mr. Bellinger's testimony that he read...
I'm sorry, let me ask the question again.
It's a partial read.
Let me finish.
It's a careless read.
He either didn't read it or he read it and didn't grasp the significance, or there's a third alternative that I don't know how to articulate. Where are we here?
The court found on page 29 that he read the entire of the agreement between the parties, the first joint venture agreement, and thereafter he relied on his attorneys and Mr. Argemon, who worked for him, to bring to his attention the parts that he needed to read, and then he read them. It's a partial read case. And he says that Mr. Bellinger was not negligent. He exercised proper care and oversight. So we're in exactly the same case as Cerberus, where there was a failure on the part of a party to read an agreement carefully enough or think about it carefully enough to see the mistake, so that the court need not go any further. But even assuming that the court were to conclude that there was a complete, utter failure to read here, as the court did in its alternative holding, it's still not a defense. And in that regard, the court below first found that ASB was not negligent, that Mr. Bellinger had exercised proper care, that he had read the parts of the agreement that he needed to read, and that therefore the negligence defense did not have any factual basis.
Well, is your position that even if there was negligence, it's not a defense? Or is your argument that there simply just wasn't any negligence?
It's both, Your Honor. There's no factual basis for the defense because there was no negligence. But even assuming there was, negligence is not a defense to reformation. And the court found that in its alternative holding. He said even assuming Bellinger did not read the agreements before approving them, that would not bar equitable reformation. Scion, in its brief, leaves out the even assuming and misrepresents that the court actually concluded that, but it didn't. That's its alternative holding. But the court's right as to that alternative holding, because Cerberus shows that a failure to read is negligence that doesn't bar reformation, because Cerberus holds that negligence doesn't bar reformation. Cerberus, as you no doubt recall, was a case where the court said that any mistake claim by definition involves a party who has not read about or thought about an agreement carefully enough. Cerberus quoted the restatement, section 155, comment A, that reformation is not precluded by the mere fact that the party who seeks it failed to exercise reasonable care in reading the writing. Cerberus said that there is a rule in some other jurisdictions that a degree of fault greater than negligence can bar reformation. And it cited to section 157 of the restatement, under which the rule is that reformation is barred if the proponent did not act in good faith or in accordance with reasonable standards of fair dealing. Cerberus also cited to
fault. And is there any evidence of that in this case?
None, Your Honor. Absolutely none, and they don't argue that. And it's also clear under the restatement, section 157, that an outright utter failure to read does not bar reformation because it's negligent. The standard under 157, the restatement says, is akin to gross negligence and will be met only in extreme cases. There's a comment B that addresses failure to read. Vice Chancellor Laster quoted it in his opinion, and it says that negligence in failing to read the contract does not amount to bad faith or unfair dealing. Cerberus also cited Foster versus Gibbons, which is a case from Oregon, where you're precluded from reformation if you were grossly negligent. And the facts of that case were that the proponent had actually contributed the mistake by providing an inaccurate description of property, which she knew was inaccurate, so she had not acted in good faith. And Justice Steele, Chief Justice Steele, your opinion in that case, although it disagreed that the record facts could support the elements of reformation, which we, on the other hand, have proven by clear and convincing evidence, which they haven't appealed, your opinion did not take issue with these statements about the degree of fault of the proponent, because what Cerberus concluded about this was that this court has never adopted such a rule that a degree of fault greater than negligence can bar reformation, and took no opinion on whether under some, ventured no opinion whether under some circumstances misconduct of the proponent, again indicating a degree of fault greater than negligence, could bar reformation. So the only open question under Cerberus is, does misconduct bar reformation, not does negligence bar reformation? And it's clear, Your Honors, that a failure to read is not misconduct. It's not a failure to act in good faith or fair dealing. It's not gross negligence. How do we know? We know from Section 157's comment. We know because in Oregon, which bars reformation because of gross negligence, the rule is that failure to read is merely negligence and does not bar reformation. Excuse my Mario Rubio moment. And we also know from rules, and other jurisdictions have a rule that Pomeroy talks about in his treatise on equity, that bars reformation when a degree of fault has been shown by the proponent that amounts to violation of a positive legal duty. And Pomeroy says that those are the best authorities. Positive legal duty is ill-defined in the cases. This court's never used the term. But it's clear that failure to read does not amount to a violation of a positive legal duty anyway.
Let me step back just one minute and ask for your view on our use in service of the word misconduct. I'm not sure misconduct is a term of art with which everyone would reach a consensus, or on which everyone would reach a consensus. In order to clear up any perceived inconsistency in our law, should we readdress the use of the word misconduct and be more explicit in what would constitute a bar to reformation?
I think it would be helpful to make clear what I think is at least implied by Cerberus, that misconduct is a degree of fault greater than negligence.
If you read the reason I ask that is any run-of-the-mill tort lawyer, if there were such a thing, would consider negligence to be misconduct because it can lead to liability. So misconduct's not an apt term, one might argue.
I don't disagree. If you read the footnote 47 in Cerberus, the way it lays it out, that a degree of fault greater than negligence in some jurisdiction bars reformation. We've never adopted such a rule. We take no opinion on whether under any circumstances, misconduct can bar reformation. It seems to be referring to a degree of fault greater than negligence. But I understand your point, and I think it would be helpful to say that negligence does not bar reformation, although you don't need to say that in this case, because if you just credit the court's findings of fact, which are supported by the evidence, which I recited from Mr. Bellinger's testimony, there was no negligence. Scion cites cases which they say support their proposition, this is in its reply brief, that when you have unilateral mistake, somehow the standard of care is different, higher than in a mutual mistake case. And it's just not the case. The cases from other jurisdictions use terminology, different terminology for what Delaware calls unilateral mistake with knowing silence. And they use the words to describe it, such as unilateral mistake with inequitable conduct or fraud, because they recognize, as the restatement does in sections 161 and 166, that knowing silence is fraud, as the Chancery Court said in Kokel-Voresses. Again, which this court has relied on in the past, not for that proposition, but for its other statements about reformation. And other cases from other states also talk about what we call unilateral mistake with knowing silence being a species of mutual mistake. So that when you actually read the cases carefully, if you look at a case that seems to be addressing unilateral mistake, what it's often addressing from another jurisdiction is just unilateral mistake where there was no fault on the part of the defendant. And what the Scion has done in his reply brief, in almost every case it cites, has misread them. For example, on page 9 of its reply brief, it cites cases from Pennsylvania and New Jersey saying that in unilateral mistake cases, unlike mutual mistake cases, a failure to read or other negligence bars reformation. But that's not the case. Those cases that it cites involve no degree of fault on the defendant's part. Both Pennsylvania and New Jersey permit reformation based on what we call unilateral mistake with knowing silence, notwithstanding a failure to read or other negligence. And the citations in Pennsylvania, it's Overholt versus Reliance, 319 Pennsylvania 340. In New Jersey, it's 1404 Washington Street v. Riggins, 2009 Westlaw, 3488463.
Are these in the briefs?
They're not. That's why I just read them to you, Your Honor, in the hopes that someone in the courtroom is taking them down.
Well, were they disclosed to the other side?
They were not, because we didn't focus on this issue of whether there's any difference in the treatment of unilateral mistake with knowing silence and mutual mistake and the degree of conduct required of the proponent of reformation until they, in their reply brief, for the first time, raised that issue. So this is our first opportunity to address the argument that somehow the standard is different, which is why we did not cite them and why I read them to you, Your Honor. And their argument that the degree of care ought to be different makes no sense, because the difference between mutual mistake and unilateral mistake with knowing silence is not in the standard of care of the plaintiff, it's in the standard of care, or the conduct, rather, of the defendant. In a mutual mistake case, the defendant was mistaken, was likely careless. And in a unilateral mistake case with knowing silence, they actually engaged in inequitable conduct in the nature of fraud. And the majority opinion in Cerberus held that the facts in that case could support on remand either unilateral mistake or mutual mistake. Its statements about a proponent's standard of care, which I think fairly read, say that negligence does not bar reformation, made no distinction between mutual mistake or unilateral mistake. And under the restatement, Section 172 is what applies to unilateral mistake with knowing silence. It has the same standard for that version of reformation as the standard of conduct in Section 157 applies to mutual mistake. The court below cited the statement, restatement Section 157 comment on failure to read. That same comment is applicable to 172. I'm citing you these new sections of the restatement again because we didn't ever need to focus on this issue because they hadn't raised it before.
Well, we understand Okay. You've made that point, but our custom is when you find authority that supports your position after the briefing's complete, that you bring it to the attention of the court and your opposing counsel prior to the argument, because we haven't had a chance to read this, and Mr. Williams is not going to be in a position to respond because he hasn't had a chance to read it either.
I apologize, Your Honor. I was unaware of that rule.
Well, it's a custom.
I was unaware of the custom.
Are you planning to address the attorney's fees issue?
I will indeed, Your Honor. If I could just, can I make one final point?
Yeah, I'm not trying to cut off your argument.
I've got my eye on 5 minutes. Addressing this point about the different standard of care that they should apply in a unilateral mistake case and a mutual mistake case, again, it depends on a complete misreading of the cases. If you just read carefully the cases that they cite, you'll see that they don't apply to unilateral mistake with knowing silence, because that's fraud, that's inequitable conduct, and you need to look for those words in a case that describes unilateral mistake. But just common sense should tell you that, if anything, in a case of unilateral mistake with knowing silence, the standard of care required of the proponent should be less exacting than in a case of mutual mistake. Because in a case of mutual mistake, the defendant has been merely careless. In a case of unilateral mistake with knowing silence, they've engaged in inequitable conduct, in fraud. And that's an even more compelling case in equity for granting reformation. As long as the plaintiff did not also act badly or unfairly, the relative degree of the fault of the parties supports equitable reformation to vindicate freedom of contract by enforcing what clear and convincing evidence has shown is the real agreement of the parties, and to prevent the defendant from benefiting from his fraud and inequitable conduct by engaging in knowing silence. Let me turn to the attorney's fee issue. Can I cite your case that stands for that, even though we found it in response to their argument?
Certainly. Yes. Know that everyone's at a comparative disadvantage, but go ahead and cite it.
It's Wallace versus Spry from Iowa, 78 Northwest 2nd, 406. Same facts as ours. Plaintiff's attorney erroneously prepared the contract. Plaintiff didn't read it. Defendant observed the error and remained quiet. The court said to deny reformation would render the power of reformation that is lodged in a court of equity impotent and unavailing. Equity will not countenance that which in effect would amount to a legal fraud. And these are not legal new principles. That case was written the year I was born, 1956, the first restatement of contracts.
Counsel, I think we would like to hear the attorney's fees.
Okay. Plain meaning supports us, Your Honors. Scion focuses on the words incurred and reimbursed in the contract provision. As for incurred, the provision does not say costs incurred by the prevailing party. The provision uses the passive voice costs incurred without specifying by whom the cost must be incurred. By its terms, the provision is applicable to costs that are either incurred directly by the prevailing party or on its behalf.
Well, what about Mr. Williams' point that the costs are being incurred on the facts of this case, which are conceded by DLA, and not by an actual party to the contract? And the language of the contract has to relate to the two parties, doesn't it?
No. The costs incurred means on behalf of the party. The party, him or herself, doesn't have to incur the cost, and they don't have to be obligated to pay them.
Is it fair to say that the costs were incurred on behalf of your client, when apparently the facts are the costs were incurred by the law firm on their own behalf in order to avoid a malpractice action?
Well, certainly that was one reason that the costs were incurred, but we did incur them on behalf of the prevailing party. They were incurred in connection with the litigation. I think it would help if I told you about one of the cases we do cite in our brief, Weikert versus Faust, which was decided in 2011 by the Court of Appeals of Maryland, which is their highest court. The fee-shifting contract provision in that case used the words incurred and reimbursed in exactly the same way as our provision. It said, if manager prevails in a suit, then company shall reimburse manager for the amount of manager's fees incurred in the suit. And the court held that the company was required to reimburse the manager for fees, even though the manager did not pay them or have any obligation to pay them. The fees were paid by her new employer, which had no obligation to pay them either, but paid them. The court said that absent, this is a plain meaning argument, the court said that absent restrictive language in the contract that the party personally pay or be obligated to pay attorney's fees, the obligation to reimburse the fees refers to those fees incurred by the party or on behalf of the prevailing party.
All right. Did the argument that you just articulated to us, was that also articulated to the Vice Chancellor?
Was that argument articulated to the Vice Chancellor?
The plane,
yes.
That plane.
And it's in our brief, too, that incur does not mean just by the party. It also means on behalf of the
party. Did the Vice Chancellor deal with that plain meaning argument in those terms?
He did not address that in his opinion, no. To be as limited as Scion claims, the fee provision would need the kind of restrictive language that the Weikart versus Faust case requires. It would need to say something like, the non-prevailing party shall reimburse the prevailing party for all costs it pays or becomes obligated to pay itself in connection with such enforcement. It doesn't have that kind of restrictive language. Incurred is broad. It's passive. It refers to fees incurred by the party or on their behalf.
If the Vice Chancellor did not address the argument that you're making now, what argument are you defending? That is, what rationale are you defending?
I'm defending.
Are you making an alternative argument that would support the result?
Yeah, it supports the result. It shows why his ruling is sustained by the plain language of the contract. He dismissed these as technical arguments. They're not supported by the language of the contract either. You, of course, are free to sustain the opinion, the decision of the Vice Chancellor on whatever grounds are appropriate, and certainly the plain meaning supports us. So the fact that the Vice Chancellor didn't go into the plain meaning, I mean, I think in effect he did. What he said was that the point of the provision, the contractual point, not a policy point, the point of the provision is to allocate the responsibility between the breaching and non-breaching party. So need to fulfill their expectations. Arrangements that the non-breaching party may have made internally or with third parties to minimize or lay off its burdens, he said, do not affect the breaching party's liability. That's because they don't affect the party's expectations to the contract. Scion had no idea that DLA Piper wasn't going to charge ASB. They didn't find out about it till well into the case when they asked Mr. Bellinger at his deposition. It's completely incidental to their liability, and is a complete windfall. And as to who caused the fees here, not only did Scion engage in knowing silence at the outset, but when ASB discovered the mistake and asked Scion to correct it, they first responded with an email which the court found, which they don't challenge on appeal, made completely false statements about why there was no mistake. And then when we sent a formal demand letter asking them to do the honest thing, admit the mistake, and avoid litigation entirely, they commenced three lawsuits, and we had to sue here to try to consolidate things. And fees were incurred in four different fora, and the court found, and they don't dispute this factual finding either, that the point of all that was that Scion wanted to try to leverage a settlement it wasn't entitled to by pursuing difficult, expensive litigation. It's a complete fortuity to them.
Thank you, counsel.
That DLA did the right thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please,